freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of choice, freedom of assembly, freedom of health. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
This is Dirk Pohlmann from Germany, and a little bit unusual for you probably, but we have a reason for this. I have a very special guest today who is Jacques Baud, a former colonel of the Swiss Army and an intelligence officer. And after 1 hour, we tried to get in direct connection with my colleague Alina Lipp, who is in Donetsk right now and is under fire from several sides, which is the German law system, a state prosecutor, but also from Ukrainian artillery. But first, let's go to Mr. Jacques Baud. Mr. Baud, do you hear me? And yeah, okay.
Yes, I hear you. Good morning or good evening. Good morning. I don't know, it's evening for me. Probably morning for you.
It is, Australia is far away. But for our listeners, so I introduced a little bit, but maybe you should introduce yourself because it's an astonishing array of features that you can offer for the listeners.
Thank you. Yes, I used to be strategic intelligence officer in the Swiss Ministry of Defense. Also, I'm colonel, also colonel of intelligence. I spend quite a lot of time in the UN and peacekeeping operations. I was head of the policy and doctrine for peacekeeping operation in New York for the UN. I did the same for the African Union in Nairobi, Kenya. I spent some time in Afghanistan to establish a cooperation program for police with the European Union. I have done a lot of things. I also created the Geneva Center for Humanitarian Demining, which is as a concept used to be an intelligence structure to monitor or to help monitoring or managing the mine action programs in the world. I also created the information management system for mine action, which is currently active in 70 countries. My last assignment was in NATO, which is quite surprising for a Swiss, but that was part of an agreement between the Swiss government and NATO. And I was in charge of the counterproliferation of small arms and light weapons. And that was at the time of the Ukraine, the Ukraine incident that you had in 2014. And I monitored the flow of weapons that came into Ukraine at that time, including the Donbass. And I was also involved in some programs for improving the Ukrainian military at the request of Ukraine and to NATO. NATO helped to establish some program to revitalize the Ukrainian army, because at the time you had a lot of desertion. People didn't want to engage in the conflict. So young soldiers were defecting massively, and that was a huge problem. And today you see, by the way, the same problem coming again in Ukraine. As I said, my previous life was in strategic intelligence. I forgot to mention that my area of responsibility was the whole Warsaw Pact. So I was dealing with everything that has to do with current Russia, Ukraine, Poland, and so on, but also the forces that were abroad, including Afghanistan and South Africa, for instance. So I was in touch with Ahmed Shah Massoud, for instance, in Afghanistan to establish for him training material training material to disarm the Soviet landmines and things like this. So yes, that's in a nutshell.
You forgot one thing that you forgot to mention, and I'm very interested in, is you had been in contact with the Soviet General Staff as an envoy from Switzerland. Yeah, you should. Maybe you can explain us how that came.
Yes, that's interesting because there is some aspect that relates to a current event. Just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Switzerland started to be interested in joining NATO, and probably not NATO per se at that time, but the Partnership for Peace. And as you know, Switzerland is a neutral country, is recognized as a neutral country because, as you may or may not know, Swiss neutrality was imposed to Switzerland. It was not declared by Switzerland itself. It was imposed by Switzerland by the great powers at that time. That was early 19th century. That includes France, Germany, Italy, Austria, and so on, and Russia. And so Switzerland is very keen to keep this neutral policy, first of all, but also an image as a neutral country. Or at least it used to be, because I'm not sure it's the same today. But at that time, it was so. And therefore, before joining or making any attempts to join NATO or so, we wanted to know a little bit what was the feeling among major actors in the world. And one of the major actors was, of course, Russia. And so we went to Russia. We met with the highest level of command of the Russian armed forces. We also met political high-ranking political officials in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Defense, and including at a time that was the FSB, the Secret Service, wanted to know what they feel about Switzerland joining NATO. And that was an interesting move because, as you know, today you have Sweden and Finland doing exactly the same thing, but they didn't consult anybody. And in Switzerland, the first move was very much to consult everybody to know what they feel about it. And that's exactly what you see today. Sweden didn't do that. Well, the interesting thing that we had the end of the Cold War with the Russians is that we were surprised to see how happy they were. They were to have got rid of communism, and they had a lot of hope, including the hope of joining NATO, and that's why they were extremely positive when we asked whether they would be annoyed or disturbed by neutral Switzerland getting closer to NATO. They were absolutely not annoyed at all. On the contrary, they supported us very clearly. And they even told us that they also contemplated the idea of joining or getting closer to NATO. And shortly after that, by the way, they joined the Partnership for Peace together, and I think they shared almost the same building with Switzerland, I think, in the NATO headquarters here in Brussels. So it was very interesting to see that for the Russians, the Cold War was completely over. That was totally over. They had very much in mind a new era, a completely new, let's say, relationship with the West. And they were absolutely positive towards NATO and everything. And that probably explains why during the first years after the end of the Cold War, when countries like the Baltic states, Poland, and so on, started to join NATO, Russia was not so much, didn't react against that. They were not against that. The problem came when the U.S. Started to talk about deploying missiles in Poland and Romania and the Czech Republic. Of course, Well, the Americans always alleged that these missiles were anti-ballistic missiles to counter a possible Iranian threat. The problem is that the Iranians have no missiles that can reach Europe. And I'm not aware they have even started to build any since the 20 years ago. And the second point is that those launchers that you had in Poland and Romania are of dual use, in fact. That means that you can launch anti-ballistic missiles, but you can also launch cruise missiles. With nuclear warhead, obviously. So that means that for Russia, this move from the US started to ring a bell. And that's when they started to be upset, in fact. They were not against
other countries. Let's go back a little bit. Let's go back a little bit. I remember that Yeltsin called Manfred Werner, the general secretary of NATO, and he considered him a very important person because the general secretary in the Soviet Union was a very important man, and he asked to join NATO. And Werner was a little bit astonished. And then also, I think Putin at one time asked if Russia could join NATO. So that... And was that when you were talking to them? Was it still Soviet Union, or was it after 91 when it became Russia?
That was after 91. The Russians or the Soviets at the time already made a request in the 50s, in the mid-50s or something like that. But obviously we were in the Cold War, so nobody took that very seriously.
NATO was founded in 1949, and the Warsaw Pact was later. I think it happened when Germany joined NATO in 56.
Exactly. Exactly. It was 1 week after Germany joined the NATO, the Warsaw Pact was created, just 1 week later in April 1955. The interesting thing with these requests is that it departs from the very idea of what the Soviets or the Russians, or better said, what the Russians had in mind regarding Europe. The idea of European security within the Russian establishment was a security through cooperation and not through confrontation. And that's why for them, it was absolutely no contradiction in having two nuclear powers within NATO. But the problem, as you just said, NATO was created in 1949. At the time when NATO, the US obviously was the only Western power to have nuclear weapons. And the idea of NATO, and still today, by the way, the idea of NATO was to take all these European countries under the US nuclear umbrella. And the thing is that from a US perspective, and that's the reason why NATO is always headed or led by an American, a US military, because it has this nuclear dimension. But and in US view, it was unthinkable to have two nuclear powers within the same organization. That's why there were some intellectual movements in Europe, but also in Russia, to say NATO should change, because the basic principle, the basic concept of NATO is not adapted or suitable for the current security or international security situation. But the Americans still want to have this primacy in terms of nuclear power. And that's the reason why NATO was very reluctant to integrate the Russians. Now, when you talk about there were those requests. And of course, when you mention Manfred Werner in the 90s, we also have to talk about the NATO enlargement. As I said before, mm-hmm. although you had some East European country joining NATO, Russia didn't react really. But in fact, we have to remember that when Germany reunified, and soon after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was a discussion whether the federal Germany and the Democratic Republic of Germany should reunify. So we knew that this idea was to come up. So there were already some discussions early 1990 between the US and the Russians. And we have to remember that Russia, or Soviet Union, better said, Soviet Union in 1945 was one of the winners of Second World War. And in that capacity, Soviet Union was one of the four powers who were entitled to or supposed to manage security policy of Germany. And that's the reason why you had within Germany, you had on the Western side, you had the British, the French, and the US sector. And on the Eastern side, you had the Soviet sector. And Berlin was also divided according to those sectors. But that means that when it was a question of reunifying Germany, the Western countries had to have the agreement of Soviet Union. They couldn't do otherwise. They had to have the Soviet agreement. And that's the reason why the Soviets at the time, but still Soviet Union at the time, the Soviet Union asked as a condition to have Germany reunified, as a condition that NATO should not extend toward the East. That was a clear condition. That was never set on a treaty or on a paper. That was never, and that was probably, that was the big mistake of Mikhail Gorbachev. He never asked. In fact, he trusted the Western powers. I think the Russians had a very high consideration for Western powers, and for that
may
reason,
I just interrupt you here? I think yes, there's sure. One thing that would be interesting to the listeners that at that time I think Gorbachev had a reason to trust that, because there was a standing, let's say, rule that the main people from a country, if they were in negotiations, their word would be as good as it as written down. And I can give you a good example, which is the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Americans and the Soviets in the end negotiated, better to say, Khrushchev and Kennedy, which got along quite well. They negotiated that the Soviets would retract their missiles from Cuba and the Americans would retract their missiles from Turkey, where they had stationed them, also nuclear missiles. It was a two-sided agreement, and that was never written down. It was orally between Khrushchev and Kennedy. So there is even in that in that important case, it was not written down. So Gorbachev had a reason to trust the old standards.
Yes, absolutely.
Of diplomacy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think that there were good reasons for the Soviets to trust the Americans and the Western powers in general. The thing is that of course U.S. changed over time, and with the Bush administration in the early 2000s, the mindset in the U.S. changed totally. I mean, in fact, the mindset of the US changed.
I think I have to interrupt you again, Mr. Bort. We have to, we have to switch to the ads, but we get back to this interesting story of the negotiations in Germany and the trust or not trust of the Soviet Union and the Allied forces, the Allied governments rather. So here's to the ads and then we get back.
Michael Parker on TNT Radio.
We've decided what we've decided, but there's also this other group of people that just seem like they are impervious to this information. They just refuse to have any of it, perhaps because they think they will be ostracized from their social groups or from their jobs or from their church or whatever it is. But do you think even approaching a tipping point yet?
I do. There, I don't have access to through the proof to demonstrate what's going on several levels above us. And the way that I like to frame it is that all the facts are on our side and we only have the BS and obfuscation on our opponent's side. And from all appearances, as you say, is that we need help from friends in high places. Personally stand at 95% certainty that what we're all witnessing is the show.
Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
My name is Latoy Adams. I served in the Army. Being with paralyzed veterans of America, they have showed me so much is possible.
I'm Sean Castle, served in the United States Army. I went from laying in a hospital bed dying to being a professional wheelchair basketball player. And it started with that one moment where there's life. I am unstoppable because Paralyzed Veterans of America is by my side.
We are unstoppable.
Learn more at pva.org.
For the news and talk you can't hear anywhere else.
It gives you some awareness of what's really going on.
Where things are at, even around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, and here we are back. You get a little bit of a European perspective today. I'm Dirk Pohlmann, a German journalist, and I'm talking to Jacques Beau, a former Swiss intelligence officer. And we were talking about the time of German reunification that started 89 with the fall of the wall, and then it went on down to 1991 or 92, all the negotiations. We were talking about the four power situation in Germany. And I'll just hand over to Jacques Beau again. I wanted to remind everybody at that time, Britain was not at all happy about German reunification. They feared for a new Fourth Reich. France was a little bit reluctant. America was quite interested in it because I think they saw the possibility to enlarge to the east. Yeah, although the negotiations at that time said no. Bases and no weapons there. But I hand over to Jacques Beau with deep knowledge about the situation. So this is where we stop the negotiations.
Yeah, thank you. Now, at that time, it's interesting that just during that period, I was working as researcher in the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. And of course, one of the big subjects of discussion was German reunification. And it's interesting to see that there were extremely mixed feelings about this. And An interesting point also is that a lot of people, including in the intelligence community, I mean, the Western intelligence community, some people said that the Soviet Union would never allow Germany to reunify. That's interesting. Although you had discussions ongoing between Gorbachev and Western James Baker and Genscher in Germany and so on, you had this sense within the military establishment and the intelligence establishment that the Russians eventually will not accept that. And I remember that I was at the same time, I mean, I was sent from my intelligence structure to in the IISS in London. But then when I came back to Switzerland, we had extensive discussion within the international intelligence community, I mean, the Western intelligence community. And I could see that several countries in Europe didn't think that it would, that this reunification would ever happen. This is very interesting. The Germans were, of course, the most optimistic. But the other ones you had, as you just said, they were in the UK intelligence community. A lot of people were very much skeptical about this and skeptical about the Soviet reaction at that time. But anyway, this eventually happened. And I think the idea for a while, I mean, during the president of the current U.S. president at that time,
Bush.
I think everybody understood that was Bush, the first George Bush, that was this idea that it would be a good thing for security in Europe. And I think there was a genuine interest at that time in seeing Germany reunified and having a more appeased relationship within Europe. I think at that time there were a kind of a small euphoria, and that happened. That was very obvious just after German reunification. A kind of a euphoria that the Cold War was definitely behind us, and we had a new era of cooperation. And I think that was on all sides. That was the thinking. The thing changed a little bit after the Gulf War, because after the Gulf War, the U.S. realized that they had the only viable and powerful capability of power projection in the world, and that they were the only ones able to conduct a war abroad, basically, but also that they had also this political supremacy. And I think that's the starting point with the Americans of this sense of hegemony.
I think there's a famous article that it was Cheney and Wolfowitz came with an article stating exactly that they are the only ones who nobody can have the same power projection as the United States. And just to go a little bit back, it was Gorbachev. His idea was German reunification. Neutral Germany. That was his idea. It should be kind of a buffer zone, a zone between the West and the East. That was his wish. That Germany reunification. Yes, I even heard from people as early as 1986. For example, Alfred Herrhausen came back and reported that the possibility of a German reunification was there on the Soviet political side, but the idea was neutralization of Germany, not being a member of NATO. And then he accepted reluctantly that Germany would stay in NATO. This is what the Western powers wanted. Kohl was very happy about it, that it was possible. But from this, you can see this whole discussion that we've seen in the last years. If it was a written agreement that NATO should not be enlarged to the east, Gorbachev would have never, in that it was not a topic at that time, because it was clear that it was that we're going into the future and Germany would be reunified, but it would be a peaceful future. It was not a future of power projection and global hegemony. That came later on, as you said. So we are in this time frame after, that is 1992, I think, when I read this this papers from Wolfowitz and Cheney, and they basically said, we are the only big cheese in the world. We can do whatever we want. Nobody can prevent us. So how will we organize the world? And it came to the point where also Fukuyama said, it's the end of history. So democracy has won, and it will be. And it came the idea of the new American century. So I think that all joins in there, right?
Absolutely. No, I think it's very good that you remember this aspect. This paper, this famous paper of Cheney and Wolfowitz, which became known more or less, it was slightly modified later, but in the main aspects, it was known as the Wolfowitz doctrine, basically. And it's still people tend to forget it, but it's still the main thinking pillar of U.S. strategy today. It's very interesting. Just coming back also to one aspect that you mentioned, this neutral Germany, and when you talk about neutralization of Germany, we can think about this idea of neutralization of Ukraine today.
Yes.
And the idea of neutralization is not just an intellectual thing. It's the, as you know, well, when NATO was created, as I said before, the idea was to bring all the allies under the nuclear umbrella. Now, at that time, we were just talking about strategic nuclear weapons. But with the time, and especially in the 70s and in the 80s, nuclear weapons became smaller and became even tactical or operational weapons. And the problem with that is that you, as soon as you come with tactical nuclear weapons or even operational nuclear weapons, then you come into a dissymmetric situation. When you had just strategic weapons, then you had a symmetric situation. I mean, you Soviet Union was attacking or would attack USA, or USA would attack Soviet Union, period. And if anything would happen against an ally, it would fit into that scheme. But with tactical nuclear weapons, then you come into another kind of logic, because that means that the nuclear warfare or the nuclear war could be contained in a very small territory, and namely European territory. That means that basically the US or the Soviets could use nuclear weapons on European territory, and that would not automatically mean that their own territories, that mean the Soviet territory on one hand and the US territory, would be touched by this or concerned by these nuclear weapons. And but obviously, due to the geography, even if you'd use tactical weapons, or operational weapons, that creates an imbalance, because Soviet Union is closer to the nuclear battlefield and could endure the consequences of a nuclear war in Europe. So with this kind of weapon, you have a dissymmetry. And that's the reason why the Soviets and the Soviet strategists recognized this problem, and therefore they started, especially in the 80s, to have a neutral Germany, or even they had this idea of neutral Europe and Germany, especially. And that, in fact, was the whole discussion about the Pershing II and SS-12, 22 in the late 80s. The early 80s, sorry, in Germany. And that was also, by the way, the starting point of the peace movement in Germany, a very strong peace movement. So we had the
biggest demonstrations ever in Germany here. And for the listeners, these are medium range rockets. So it was, it would be a European war. And also maybe a reminder, France under de Gaulle decided to become a nuclear weapons state itself, which the Americans didn't like a bit at that time. And de Gaulle said the Americans will not sacrifice Washington for Paris, but Paris for Washington.
Exactly.
So that was his idea, that he should be able to do it himself. And that's exactly what you described, Mr. Bode. Yeah?
Exactly. And by the way, I wanted to come to this point, but it's very good that you mentioned it, this idea that US would not trade New York or Los Angeles or Washington against a city in Europe. And that's exactly the point with Sweden and Finland today. I think and that's also the reason why Russia had in mind this neutralization of when they say neutralization, basically is not having neutral nuclear weapons. Doesn't mean that those countries should not have an army. This is not the idea. By the way, Switzerland is neutral, and Switzerland has has been reduced since the Cold War, but it had one of the biggest army in Europe. So the question of neutralization has
and also
to do with
it is there's Sweden of, the case of Sweden, which had the fourth largest air force in the world. That's not a lot of people know that.
Exactly. And Switzerland had the third largest armored howitzer in the West. I mean, I think we were just after the U.S. and Germany. We had an incredible armament and arsenal in Switzerland. So neutrality doesn't mean that you are not unarmed. But in the Soviet mind and the Russian mind, the idea of neutralization means that you don't have nuclear weapons, and that you are neutralized in terms of nuclear assets. And that's that's why they were upset when US started in 2004 to have those discussions with Czech Republic, Poland, and Romania. So, and of course, later with the question of Ukraine asking for being a full member of NATO, this was totally unacceptable for Ukraine, for Russia, because of this problem of neutralization. I mean, if Ukraine would be a full member, then nothing would prevent the deployment of nuclear weapons on Ukraine territory. And so that's the idea. And this question of Europe being the nuclear theater of war is something that a lot of people tend to forget today. So and that's a problem, in my view, that's a problem of NATO today. The logic of having everybody under a nuclear umbrella was certainly an interesting idea in the 50s, but today with small and tactical weapons, it means basically that you could have the whole Europe could be basically completely nuclearized, so to say, without that, because the US would not bomb Moscow just because nuclear tactical weapons were used against Bern or Paris or Berlin. So this is this kind of dissymmetry that scared a little bit the Russians, because they say with this dissymmetry, the US can use nuclear weapons in Europe while we would be affected without being directly attacked with nuclear weapons, but that would affect us directly. And that's also the reason why there was several efforts from the Russians and the Soviets at the time to have nuclear-free zones and things like that, because they are always afraid that the ability of the two superpowers to fight at nuclear level would have consequences, unintended consequences on their own territory. So that's a little bit the situation that we had in the early 90s.
May I wrap up a little bit that we have the situation in Europe, and as a reminder, it was between Gorbachev and Reagan that they had the decision to ban completely medium-range rockets. That's a rare case where a whole set of weapons was, by negotiation, minimized. And that's how great this time of 1989, when Strolling at River Moskva was in the song there. We go to the ads and we come back and we fast forward then to the situation right now, because the question really is what happened, what went wrong? Yeah. So to the ads now.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
Jerome Bell will be on the ballot in the 21st of June Republican primary for Virginia's 2nd Congressional District, but Google has effectively censored his website, jeromebellforcongress.com. The legacy media has either censored or slandered him, but Jerome Bell does have significant endorsements, including from Lieutenant General Michael Flynn and Thomas Homan, former US Director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In an interview with the Smithfield Times in early June, Jerome Bell provided straight talking on several issues. Regarding policy towards Ukraine, he said, "Throwing billions of taxpayer dollars to the number three corrupt nation in the world to try and prop up one dictator over another while enriching their oligarchs is bad policy." Jerome Bell faces three other GOP candidates in next Tuesday's GOP primary. If he secures a shock victory, expect some political fireworks. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And here we are back with Dirk Pullman and Jacques Baud. So we were talking about this situation where from the days of 89, when we thought that it would be peace, there was the possibility of world peace really on the horizon. And then we went on until this situation in the early 2000s, and maybe you can take from there, Mr. Baud. So what really went wrong? Was it evil Putin who had his own plans to get back the Soviet Empire? How would you describe what happened?
No, I don't think so. What happens in the 90s was that under the Yeltsin power, we have to realize that Soviet Union as a country was a country that was permanently at war, so to say. That means the Soviets at the time really lived as like in a war economy. They didn't have access to usually consumer goods and things like that. It was an economy that was directed at the preparation of war, so to say. They were the Russians are extremely anxious. In fact, they were extremely anxious because they always expected an attack from the West, rightly or not. I'm not judging that, but that's a fact. So when and they always dreamed about the West. I mean, the Western way of life, and you know, access to the common consumer goods and jeans and whatever you may think about as a consumer. That sounds stupid today, but that they were deprived of that during the communist time. So when the communism faded away or imploded, as you want, in the early 1990, it was a little bit like it's a little like a bottle of champagne. If you open it too quickly, then there is champagne all over the place. And that's a little bit what happened with the Soviet society. It opened too quickly, and that was uncontrolled, literally uncontrolled capitalism, in fact, that came in the power. So you had this oligarch who started. They were the smartest guys, in fact. They purchased the state-owned companies at a very low price, and they resold them at extremely high price. So they became billionaires within months or so. And you had a lot of
if I may just step in, because I talked to people in Russia, and the point was Gorbachev had the idea of handing over the huge companies. He was trying to decentralize Russia. That was one of the main things. And he had an idea that he got from Sweden, from Olof Palme, that is, that the employees of the companies should be also at least partly owners. So a lot of these people got shares or papers which said you own something like that fraction of the company. And the oligarchs went on and said, now you have this paper, but what do you do with it? I give it, if you give it to me, I give you $2,000 and you can buy a car for that. You we had to wait for a long time to get a car, but now you can get one. And by this, they, for example, grabbed all these shares, and then they were the owners of these. So it was the smarties, so to speak, who took over. And this is also why Gorbachev is hated now in Russia. He has lower sympathy ratings than Stalin in Russia. That is because it all went haywire. And then came Yeltsin, and I'd been in Russia at that time, and you saw, you know, I know stories from people that the teacher fainted in the classroom because he had nothing to eat. There at the train stations, you would see old women selling apples because they wouldn't get a pension from the state anymore. It was and it was a complete breakdown of the society. There was crime everywhere. You drove with a car and you were stopped by policemen asking you for money. Or you wouldn't go on. There were gangsters everywhere. It was kind of a caricature of capitalism that they got. And that is, I think that needs to be understood in the West, that the Yeltsin years in Russia are the worst that they ever encountered, really. Maybe even from the Russian perspective, worse than Stalin, because it was a complete breakdown.
Absolutely. I think it's an excellent picture that you're depicting right now. I think it's exactly the problem. And the military was demobilized also. Since they didn't know what to do, they created some kind of mafias and things like this. So I think we had, and that's that time, and at that time we had this ideas of Russian mafias and things like this. And that was a terrible time. And when Putin came to power in 2000, he started to put some order in that. By the way, it's interesting to see that the Russian example is exactly this example, or the counter example, that drives Chinese internal policy today. As you see, they opened a bottle of champagne extremely slowly. They grant the rights for having billionaires, and although they officially are Communist Party, by the way. So that means they have understood that if you have suddenly a sudden change in the society, then people will take advantage of that, and that leads to the big problems and the chaos. So in Russia, that was the approach of Putin as he came to power. He came, as everybody knows, he came as a KGB background and FSB background, FSB being the successor of the KGB, and he started to put some order into that. So he started to fight the oligarchs that you just mentioned before, and started to restructure the economy. And that was that's a long-term business, basically. I think in the West, we didn't understand that, because from a Western perspective, we don't see much changes, or the changes do not appear very obvious. Although if you go in Moscow today, you will see a completely different city that you had 20 or 30 years ago. So there are changes, but they are not so obvious. The economy is a robust economy, but it's not a flamboyant economy. It's not a very flashy economy. You don't have big products like, I don't know, iPhones or Apple or whatever. You don't have these kind of things, but you have an economy that is rather robust, solid, based on export of raw materials, as we experience these days, but also on the production of equipment, manufacture, mechanical, electronics, and things like this. So I think slowly Putin developed this economy. And that's also the reason why we see today that the sanctions do not work well against Russia, because the economy is, as I said, is very robust. For instance, Putin noted that Russia would be weakened by having too much debt, for instance. So he tried and managed to reduce the national debt, and Russia is one of the less indebted country in the world. And that's also the reason why the sanctions do not work, because Russia basically doesn't depend on the rest of the world. And that was the work of Putin. And that went well at the beginning, because I think everybody realized that Russia needed restructuration and to eliminate the chaos that was in the country. But the problem started, I think the very start of all the problems we have today is when the U.S.
Mr. Bo, I have to interrupt you before, because we're going into the news in about 30 seconds. So I want to wrap up a little. We are talking about how the situation shifted. Yep. And in the next hour, we'll take China into the picture, because China should not be forgotten in this case of the Ukraine war. It is really the big strategic picture is including this question. And it's also the question Russia and Germany. That is a very old yes. question in history for about 100 years, where we can say that the Americans and the British, the Anglo-Saxon Empire, so to speak, if you like, you can add Australia and New Zealand to that, the Five Eyes,